Welcome, everybody. So glad you guys are here with us tonight. So it's not all that unusual to see celebrity scandal in the news these days. So-and-so split after a five-year marriage, or this celebrity's history of alleged sexual misconduct has been exposed. Blank celebrity arrested for possessing and selling drugs. It could have been a celebrity that you enjoyed. You've seen some of their stuff and you think, oh, wow, bummer. They seemed like a nice person. I guess I don't really know them or what goes on behind closed doors. Or maybe you just don't care. You're like, I don't read the headlines. You just shrug it off. It doesn't matter to me. And when you get to famous Christians, it gets a little more interesting. Somehow our modern Christian culture has elevated these Christians with a platform. We listen to their podcasts, we read their books, we follow them on Instagram. Some of them are even called celebrity pastors, which I don't think was ever the intention of the early church. But not all of it is bad. Many of these believers understand that they have been given a platform, and they really try and faithfully use that platform to speak truth, knowing they have an opportunity to share the gospel with great impact in a big way. But then you come across a headline about one of those Christians, and it just gets a little closer to home. Fired Hillsong New York City pastor Carl Lentz apologizes for infidelity. Deep in the heart of megachurch country, Dallas mourns a summer of pastor scandals. Trinity Church grieves in shame after pastor Art Azurdia admits to sexually immoral acts. Ravi Zacharias hid hundreds of pictures of women, abuse during massages, and a rape allegation. Those headlines are humbling. And if I had read any other celebrity name in the headline, it's easier to stomach. But knowing that those are Christians, Christian pastors, people of influence, people who preach the truth of God, it just stings even more. Christian leaders or these celebrity pastors, or maybe especially these celebrity pastors, are not immune to the enticing lure of sin. And unfortunately, our passage tonight shows us that this story has been going on since the beginning. Our heroes of faith are just as broken and imperfect as we are. How's that for an intro? Like, giddy up, let's go. So we've been working through Genesis, and Michael talked with us through the flood narrative last week, kind of spanning around Genesis chapters 6 through 9. Wickedness was everywhere. The earth was corrupt and filled with violence in the sight of God. But God found Noah, a righteous man. He was blameless, and Noah walked with God. God gives Noah instruction to create a structure that would hold this human, Noah, and protect him and his family and the animals through the flood. So Noah was a remnant rescued through the chaos waters, the decreation of the world, where the waters that were once separated to the waters above and the waters below came crashing back together. Then God stilled the waters and caused dry land to come out of the waters, and then the ark lands upon a mountain. Calming chaos waters so a human can reside on dry land? Come on. This is really good. I've heard this before. This is echoing Genesis 1 and 2, is it not? And is this motif not going to echo again in Exodus, where God sends a wind to separate the waters of the Red Sea so that Israel can walk across dry land? And so what about that wind or spirit over the waters in the flood? Well, Noah sends out a dove over the water to see if the water had dried up yet. A dove over the waters, almost like the Spirit of God hovering over the waters in Genesis 1-2, or the Spirit of God descending like a dove as Jesus is baptized through the waters. Clearly this story is very linked with the rest of the Bible, all over the Bible. It's wild. So God tells them to exit the ark and go onto the dry land with the living creatures and animals and creeping things on the earth. Okay, again, this sounds like Genesis 1. So we're going to take a look at some verses and see how similar they are. So we have Genesis 1:24, and we can compare it with Genesis 8:17. I made Julia smash these verses onto one slide so you could see the comparison. So if it looks like a lot of words on one slide, you can blame me. But we have the repeated phrases of bringing forth living creatures or bringing out every living thing, the animals or cattle or beasts, the repetition of the creeping things, and then the repetition of on the earth. Okay, so this parallel with Genesis 1 and Genesis 8, where we're at. Okay, the next couple of verses, we have Genesis 1:28, which looks a lot like Genesis 9:1. Be fruitful and multiply is what was told to Adam and Eve, and fill the earth. The same thing was said to Noah and his sons. Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth. And then finally, in Genesis 1:27 and Genesis 9:6, we have the repetition that God created man, and that man was made in the image of God. So this post-flood state, where Noah is on the earth, it sounds just like the post-creation state of Adam and Eve on the earth. The author of Genesis is using the same language purposefully, the same words, to very intentionally bring our attention to place these two stories together, showing us that Noah is a new Adam. So just as these promises and this dominion was given to Adam, Noah has dominion over the animals as well. He's given food to eat, and he is now to restart this new creation. Noah was the righteous one, right? He was the blameless one, so he's got to be the perfect one to create this new humanity. Isn't he going to be the descendant of Eve who is going to destroy the serpent? Well, let's go to Genesis 9:18, and we'll read where our story picks up tonight. Now the sons of Noah, who came out of the ark, were Shem and Ham and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. All right, three sons from Noah. Got it. Verse 20. Then Noah began farming and planted a vineyard. Ah, he's cultivating the ground, and he's planting seeds, and he's growing vines that will bear fruit. He's in a garden. Now, the last time someone was in a garden, and there was fruit that was seen desirable, and then it was taken, and then that human found themselves naked. Yeah, so the last time that happened, things didn't turn out too well. And it's almost as if I know exactly what is about to happen. Verse 21, he drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself inside his tent. No, Noah, you are supposed to be the one of the good ones. You were the righteous one. But instead, he drank the fruit of the garden. He drank too much of it, and he is naked in his tent. He is not a new and improved Adam. In fact, he's actually just like Adam. Now, this next part gets a little weird. Genesis 9:22-24. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both of their shoulders and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done to him. So Ham, Noah's son, saw the nakedness of his father, which we'll look at some different definitions of what that could mean in a second. And then he goes and tells his two brothers. His two brothers then get a garment and put it over their shoulders to create a covering between them to shield their father. So imagine two people, you and another person, you grab some sort of garment, a cloak, I don't know, something that you can put over your shoulders. You guys both put it over your shoulders, so it's now creating this shield. And so then what they do is they start walking backwards, so they're faced. Noah's naked behind us. They're walking backwards so that they don't see the nakedness of their father. And then they throw that garment back to cover him up. Okay, so that's what's happening. And then Noah wakes up. He knew what Ham had done, and then he's going to curse him. So what exactly did Ham do? This is debated, as you can guess. But one scholar, Alan P. Ross, in the Bible Knowledge Commentary, sets out some different views for us. He says the basic question concerns what Ham, Noah's youngest son, did and why Noah's cursed Ham's son, Canaan. Many fanciful ideas have been proposed. The rabbis said Ham castrated Noah, thus explaining why Noah had no other sons. Others claim that Ham slept with his mother, thus uncovering his father's nakedness, and that Canaan was the offspring of that union. Others have said that Ham was involved in a homosexual attack on his father. So there's three perspectives. Ross, though, thinks that this should actually just be reigned at a more plain value. He says, but the Hebrew expression here means what it says. Ham saw his father's nakedness. He was not involved with Noah sexually, for in that case, the Hebrew would be translated, he uncovered his father's nakedness. Instead, Noah had already uncovered himself, and then Ham saw him that way. So this scholar's belief is that no funny business went down, but what we do know is that seeing his father naked was still very disgraceful. He continues, to the ancients, however, even seeing one's father naked was a breach of family ethic. The sanctity of the family was destroyed, and the strength of the father was made a mockery. So we don't really know what happened, but clearly something weird went down. It was not honorable. It was not good. What Noah did in getting drunk and then being naked in his tent was not good. And then Ham seeing his father, whether intentionally to do a malicious act or unintentionally, it was not good. And while the story is less inclined to give us the details of what happened in the tent, the author does focus on the contrast between Ham and his two brothers. Ham saw his father's nakedness. Shem and Japheth did not. The difference is the basis for Noah's cursing and blessing at the end of the chapter. So clearly there was some reason why Ham is going to get a curse because of what he did. Here's another great quote from John Silhammer on this as well. In covering their father's nakedness, Shem and Japheth were like Adam and Eve, and like God, who did not look upon human nakedness, but covered the nakedness with coats of skin. By contrast, Ham did not follow that lead. His actions were more like those of whom God warned later in the Torah, who exposed their own nakedness before God and humankind. The sons of Noah are here shown to belong to two groups of humankind. Those who are like Adam and Eve hide their shame and of their nakedness, and those who are like Ham, or rather the Canaanites, have no sense of their shame before God. The one group, the line of Shem, will be blessed, but the other, the Canaanites, can only be cursed. Okay, so we have the sin of Noah, who was just like the sin of Adam, whose son Ham sinned, just like Cain sinned. So what do we do with this? Well, the story held hope. While we know that Adam and Eve failed, that's okay, we've already accepted that. There was a promise that another descendant was going to come, and sure enough, Noah was righteous. He was kind of like the only righteous one. If we were going to look to anyone to give us hope, to show us the way of Yahweh, it was going to be Noah, right? But then he failed too. This brings us back to my first point. The story hits a little close to home because we, too, have seen people rise and fall. Christians, famous authors who write our favorite Bible study, theologians who have influenced how we think about our faith, pastors who have transformed our lives with helpful and practical steps of how to walk in obedience. We look to these leaders, pastors, speakers, authors, parents, friends, and think, they know what they're doing. They know the way of Jesus. But the reality is that we have elevated these people of faith and viewed them in a light which makes it impossible for them to do any wrong. There's a little more clear idolatry when we have rose-colored glasses on and we think that person is a super Christian. Next level, different league, they're just built different. They're so holy or so sanctified that I'm confident that they've never had a bad thought in their life. And so you can tell, okay, at a deeper glance, we can agree that's not true. We know that they have sinned, but have they? Because we know that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But then there's another way to look at it, another way that we've elevated Christians in our lives, and it's not always intentional, and actually I think it's a lot easier to do. We see someone who is genuinely following the Lord. Maybe they have a great marriage or a great family. They speak good biblical truth. There's no scandals in sight. And we think, this person is going to show me the way of Jesus. If I could just do what they're doing, I think I would have a little bit better of a handle on how to follow Jesus. If only I could master the spiritual disciplines like John Mark Comer, or have an emotionally healthy spiritual life like Pete Scazzaro, the meditative biblical knowledge of Tim Mackey, the pastoral and cultural impact of Tim Keller, the daily faithful Bible study of Beth Moore, the ability to defend my faith like Lee Strobel. They know what they're doing. They are the ideal. I need to look more like them. Noah was the righteous one. He was the only good person left on the earth. I need to look more like him. I have a distinct memory of a sermon I heard when I was in high school. Now, be honest, have you ever thought about how few sermons you actually remember? Honestly, what was the last sermon you heard, and what was it about? And if it was last week, and the only reason why you remember was because I already told you that Michael talked us through the flood, then that doesn't count. Or what was the subject of any sermon I've ever preached? That was rhetorical. No need to answer that. But don't worry, I've been there too. I also, admittedly, do not remember very many sermons. And I give sermons. And actually, this one particular high school sermon that I'm thinking of, I don't even remember the topic of the sermon, but it impacted me when I was in high school. And it was at youth group. After the sermon, you would go with your small group, and the small group leader would ask questions about the sermon. So we would discuss what we learned, how it impacts our life, what we want to do differently. So I can't tell you what the sermon was about. My guess is that it was something about honesty or confession or sin, but I remember the pastor ended it by saying, "There's only one small group question I have for you. Who is going to go first?" Meaning, now is your opportunity to be honest with your small group. Tell them the burden you're carrying. And the assumption is not that only one or two people will have something to say. Actually, everyone will go. Everyone will have something to say. And the question is simply going to be, who's going to go first? That sermon had an incredible impact on me because it led to a small group discussion where I was honest for the first time with my small group about a lot of things in my life. I shared struggles and sin and burdens I had never shared before, and so did the other girls in my group. We realized we were all a lot more alike than we thought. And I reflected on that sermon. Actually, I mean, so many years now, I still think about that sermon, or that question, I should say, after the sermon. And I would think, wow, that pastor knows what he's doing. He's not afraid of confessing his sins or being honest with people. Also, he's an incredible speaker, compelling. He asks thought-provoking questions. I really looked up to him. He was fun. He made everyone laugh. I loved every time he preached. But sometime later, and after he had moved on to another church, a secret affair scandal broke out about him and a girl who had just graduated high school. He stepped down from being a pastor, but now today he's completely left the church, as far as I know, has started a totally different life. So much so that he's completely changed his name. I can only imagine to distance himself from the Christian and pastoral life he once lived. That was high school. Now on to college. There was this really cool church called Mars Hill in Seattle. The pastor, Mark Driscoll, had a way of engaging with the audience. He had authority when he spoke. He spoke truth and he was not afraid to speak it. I thought it would be so cool to hear Mark Driscoll speak. I had his books. I thought if I ever lived in Seattle, I would for sure go to his church. I would want to sing on the worship teams that led there. I was on a mission trip in the Seattle area, and our group decided to attend Mars Hill Church since we were there on a Sunday. They had several different campuses, and we went to the one that he normally preached at. And so I thought, perfect, I'm going to get to hear him speak. But of course, he happened to be preaching at a different campus that day, so we just watched a live feed of him on a screen instead. So in case you are not familiar with the rise of Mars Hill Church, well, there was also a fall of Mars Hill Church. In fact, you can listen to an entire podcast series called The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill Church. Overcome by anger, pride, bullying, abuse of power, manipulation, intimidation, a sharp tongue, Mark Driscoll went from someone I once looked up to someone who was added to the list of pastors I no longer respected. That was college. Now onto my adult life, where I went through a very difficult church and pastoral change. And I know this part of my story is a part of some of you out here in the audience as well. I was deeply involved in this church from when I was in middle school until well into my adulthood. This church was woven into every aspect of my life, my friends, my community, my family, my social life. So it was that much more difficult when, you guessed it, a scandal broke out. I learned about dark and painful sin that a pastor had committed from years prior. I was close to this pastor. This pastor and his family meant and still do mean a lot to me. I had no idea that this had happened. I was confused and hurt. He did what? And then I watched the aftermath of a broken church where pastors and leaders tried to move forward, put pieces back together the best that they could, and did so imperfectly, as any human would. I assumed that although we were facing an incredibly difficult trial, that we would weather the storm together. Yet I saw fumbles and mistakes made in how things were handled or discussed as I was trying to heal from deep wounds. And it was the first time that my pastors felt human. Not that I thought that they were perfect, but it was clear to me that even pastors have human fleshly responses to things. It's like when you become an adult and you see your parents make a mistake, and then you realize, oh, right, my parents are also human. They're not perfect. They're simply doing their best, and they're not going to get it right all of the time, just like I'm not going to get it right all of the time. So I was forced to look at all these pastors and leaders in my life, over much of my life, who had failed, and then face the deeper fear, which is, if they can't do it, can't follow Jesus without messing up, how can I do it? We fall into this trap that someone else, a pastor, a Christian celebrity, a great and mighty holy one, can show us the way. We look for non-Jesus figures whose Christian life seems to work and looks good, but every single one of them will fail. Because Noah was never going to be the one who fixed everything. It wasn't Adam, it wasn't Noah, it's not going to be Abraham, it's not going to be David. No, the failure of Noah points to the fact that Jesus is the only one we can base our lives on. The failure of Noah points to the fact that Jesus is the only one we can base our lives on. I can stomach the failure of others because those failures reveal that we all need Jesus. There's no perfect pastor or Christian who is better off than the rest of us. When I base my life on Jesus, the rise and fall of leaders does not have to shake me. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, after Jesus taught how to live in his kingdom, loving others, living with kindness and generosity and grace and forgiveness, he says, "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and it fell. And great was its fall." When we base our lives on Jesus, we have a solid foundation that is not shaken when the wind and waves crash against it. He is our foundation, our solid rock. When I hear of the failings of these pastors, I don't have to think, "Oh no, is everything they've ever said untrue? Where do I stand now? What happens to my faith now because something happened in their life?" Adam and Noah failed in a garden, but Jesus will find himself in a garden right before he's about to be arrested, presented with a choice to follow God's plan or choose his flesh. He did not fail the test like Adam or Noah, and his response to the Father is not as I will, but as you will. He surrendered himself in the garden to be taken, to be killed. The scandal of Jesus is not that he sinned and fell short, but that Jesus, who knew no sin, took on our sin so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. So tonight, if you're feeling the burden of, "I have been putting too many eggs in the basket of other pastors or leaders," hopefully none of us here at Valley, that you aren't putting your hope in Michael or myself or anyone else who you see up on stage, because we will fail you. So if you feel like you're there, my spiritual walk is a little too tethered to how that person is doing or how I am following them, your house will come crumbling down because those leaders will fail. But if you're here tonight and you just need to be reminded, "Yes, Jesus is the one I need," then take heart. My own failings and the failings of others are actually just an opportunity to display the gospel. I cannot do this on my own, but I know a Savior who gave his life for me, paid the debt of my sin that I owe, and now I'm filled with his Spirit, who gives me wisdom and power to live for him. So would you close your eyes? And we're just going to have some time for prayer and reflection. I don't know where this sermon hit you tonight. Maybe there's some wounds that you've experienced. And even if you have your faith in Jesus and your foundation is in him, it doesn't change the fact that the actions of others may have caused some hurt and some pain. And maybe that pain is fresh. Maybe that pain is from a while ago. But sometimes when you think of it, it just kind of stings a little bit. The enemy wants to bring something up in your heart and make it hurt all over again. So maybe just ask the Lord to reveal those pain points and surrender those to him right now. And then ask the Lord if there are areas in your life that you have been let down by others because you were the one who put them up on that pedestal. So surrender those hopes and expectations that you have on others to the Lord. And then ask yourself, who or what is my faith based on? Is it another person? Or is it yourself? Because you think, well, I know I'm supposed to build the house on the rock, but I better get to work. I better make sure that I'm also kind of holding up my foundation a little bit to make sure that this house is really sturdy, just in case Jesus doesn't come through. You've kind of built your house upon your own facade of your own doing, that maybe will just fall like a house of cards. Is that foundation upon someone else, yourself, or is it on the Lord? Ask him ways to reveal those misdirected attention and priority and loves. Turn from those ways and turn back to him. Father, I thank you that we can boast in our weakness because your power is made perfect in weakness. That all of us can actually stand here with open hands in complete surrender, knowing that there's actually nothing that we can do to earn your love, to be good enough for you. But it was actually that when we were dead in our trespasses and sins, that Christ died for us. So I thank you for the freedom that that gives us. That we can sit here with humility and open arms and just say, thank you. Thank you that you love us here, right where we're at. And thank you, Lord, that you care about us enough to fill us with your spirit, to walk in the good works that you have set before us, because you know that walking with you is actually what brings life and brings goodness. That's actually how we're supposed to be operating. So I pray against the temptations that we face that's trying to pull us away from that. And I ask that in the moments when we do give in, we remember who we are, our true identity, that you have given us. Thank you, Lord. Amen.